We propose to give some messages on the first epistle of John, possibly one of the last writings of the New Testament. The Apostle John was the last survivor of the apostles. Tradition says he lived until he was nearly 100 years old. He lived for at least 20 years after the destruction of the temple and the dispersion of the Jewish people in AD 70. It is likely that he spent his last days in Ephesus. Four of his writings, his Gospel and the three epistles, almost certainly were written there. The book of Revelation was written in Patmos, an island in the Aegean Sea off the coast of Asia Minor, where he was in exile in approximately AD 96. The last decade of the first century was a very dangerous time for the infant church. Paul had warned the elders of the Ephesian church in AD 60 about wolves from without and false teachers from within who would attack and seek to destroy the church. This had already happened in John's day. And this is a dark background to his writings. First, let us consider the wolf from the outside. The Gnostics were a sect which arose in Asia shortly after the death of Paul in AD 67. They threatened orthodoxy for 200 years. The word Gnostic means knowledge. Those that embraced it were initiated into an elite, enlightened society by a secret initiation ceremony. It was pagan in origin and embraced various elements of paganism, Judaism, and Christianity. It was characterized by intellectual pride and at the same time considered itself superior to biblical standards of conduct and behavior. Morals were not important. In John's day, Gnosticism took two main forms. The leader of one party was Cerinthus, who lived in Ephesus. He is known to have been both a contemporary and an opponent of John. He denied the virgin birth of Christ, saying that he was the son of Joseph and Mary, according to the ordinary course of human generation. He taught that after his baptism, the Christ descended upon him in the form of a dove. Before his death on the cross, the Christ departed from him, and that it was the man Jesus who suffered and rose again. The essence of Cerinthus' error was the separation of the man Jesus from the divine Christ. The second party were called Docetists. The name is derived from a Greek verb, docking, to seem. It describes the view that Jesus was not a man in reality, but only in appearance. He seemed to the eye of those who saw him to be truly human, but it was a disguise similar to that of the Old Testament theophanies, when the angel of the Lord appeared in the form of a man. The Docetists denied the reality of his manhood and his human body. They linked evil with the flesh. His body was just a phantom. To take hold of him was just to grasp thin air. The Gospel by John and his first epistle were written to combat these errors concerning the person of Christ. Second was the danger within, as well as the attack from without. In chapter 2 and verse 19, John mentions the fact that a group had withdrawn from the church fellowship, apparently in disagreement with its teaching. A fifth column within can be more dangerous than opposition from the outside. In Paul's last letter to Timothy in AD 66, he indicated a landslide away from the faith in Asia. 2 Timothy 1:15. In John's day, this had resulted in division. He says, "They went out from us, because they were not of us." John uses three terms to describe the leaders of this movement. First, they are false prophets, chapter 4, verse 1. In the second epistle, verse 7, he calls them deceivers, and three times he calls them antichrists. In each case, he says they are many. With regard to their methods, they were seducing and deceiving the saints. Chapter 2, verse 26, and chapter 3, verse 7. These two circumstances, the attack from without on the person of Christ, and the danger of disruption within, form the background to John's first epistle. It's interesting to notice John's method of teaching. First, utter simplicity. He uses the vocabulary of a child. His words and sentences are so simple that even a child can understand, and yet so profound that a lifetime of study cannot exhaust them. Bishop Westcott called his style a monotonous simplicity of construction. John avoids big words and high-sounding nonsense of the moderns. No one has any difficulty in understanding what he is saying. Secondly, he teaches by contrast. He uses a series of opposites set in vivid contrast to each other. Life and death, light and darkness, love and hate, truth and the lie. For him, there is no neutral ground. People either belong to one or the other. They are either children of God or children of the devil. They have life or they do not have life. With him, it is either black or white. There is no neutral gray. A third principle is repetition. He is not afraid to repeat himself. But each time he comes back to a subject, he adds something fresh to it. There is a constant accumulation of doctrine. Like him, we must not be afraid to repeat the truth, go over it again and again. If it does not sink in the first time, it may make an impression on the second or the third time. In comparing the style and language of John's Gospel and this epistle, one inevitably comes to the conclusion that it was the same person, the disciple whom Jesus loved, who wrote both. There is an obvious similarity between the teaching of our Lord in the upper room, as recorded in John 13 through 17, and the doctrine of this epistle. The references are so many that the epistle could be called a commentary on our Lord's final instructions to his own. Westcott has summarized the difference between the gospel and the epistle in this way. The theme of the gospel is Jesus is the Christ. The theme of the epistle is the Christ is Jesus. John Stott makes this comment. The gospel contains signs to evoke faith, chapter 20, verses 30 to 31. The epistle gives tests in which to judge it. The epistle is not easy to analyze. The argument does not flow smoothly as it does in Romans or Galatians. Robert Law, who wrote a commentary on the epistle in 1885, calls his book The Tests of Life. He speaks of three cardinal tests. First, the doctrine, or the theological test, our attitude to the person of Christ. Second, the moral test, our attitude to righteousness and sin. Third, the social test, our attitude to love and hate. In these studies, we wish to develop and add to this suggestion. John seems to outline five tests of genuine Christianity in contrast to the spurious and the false variety. They are as follows. First, our attitude to Christ. Chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. This is basic and fundamental. Second, our attitude to sin. Chapter 1, verses 5 to chapter 2 and verse 2. Third, our attitude to our brother, chapter 2, verses 3 to 11. Do we love or hate him? Fourth, our attitude to the world, chapter 2, verses 12 through 17. Fifth, our attitude to the second coming of Christ, chapter 2, verses 18 to chapter 3, verse 3. In chapters 3 to 5, he rings the changes on these five tests, emphasizing and applying them. This is followed by three appendices. First, testing the spirits, chapter 4, verses 1 to 6. Second, a threefold witness to the truth: the Spirit, the water, and the blood. Chapter 5, verses 6 to 12. Third, a fivefold assurance of the truth: we know, we know, we know. Chapter 5, verses 13 through 20. He concludes with a final exhortation: little children, keep yourselves from idols. This epistle has a very real relevance to the present-day conditions. First-century heresies have been resurrected with modern names, but the doctrines and the attack on the person of Christ are identical. John instructs us how to combat them, and how the true believer can be fortified and kept in the midst of apostasy.